How's that? Better? So I went in about a month ago for about 10 days with a political science colleague of mine. So I want the caveat is that we did not intend for a kind of Holy Land tourism type of trip. We're both political scientists of comparative international politics, and so we went with the purpose. And I don't know why I can't make this the regular size. So you have one in front of you, looks like this. We went kind of with an intent to try to discern things about the patterns of the behavior and attitude in the conflict, obviously, that you know a lot, you hear a lot about. I discover I don't know nearly so much about it, but also people who are endeavoring for reconciliation in various ways. So I thought I'd just tell you a little bit about that and show you some pictures along the way. I had to transfer this material from my Mac book format to this format, and so I didn't get my pictures in order that I had arranged them. They came in name order, so I might be kind of slow here to find out what to put up, what pictures I need. So forgive me. We did do a tiny bit of sort of what you'd think of as typical Holy Land tourism. That's of course the Western Wall. Only hours before Mitt Romney got there, actually, but we weren't there for that. This first day in Jerusalem, we had a guide who took us around for all day, telling us interesting things. His father was an American who went back to live in Israel, as many Americans do, and has lived there 27 years and doesn't speak any Hebrew. So they're already the first kind of understanding that. And this will seem silly to you that I'll say this. Not all Jews are the same. So that's kind of one of the things I want to make sure I get clear. But this was actually the day. It was kind of hard to get into, you know, sort of around anything in this area because it was the day. There's three or four things that Jews think happened on this day. One of them was the actual day of the destruction of the temple. One of them was something else. I can't remember what it was. Several things. So this was not a high holy day, but a very a serious day in which they were kind of making sure we didn't do all manner of things they didn't like. It was interesting to go to so many places and be told, you must dress modestly, for instance. We were at an Armenian church, and you couldn't cross your legs, you couldn't put your hands in your pocket, you couldn't talk, you couldn't drink. So there's, you know, people sit down and cross their legs, and the monk comes running up. And then people start talking to me. I'm like, don't talk to me. I don't want to get in trouble. So anyway, I did do some tourism, not a ton. So let me say. I mean, I have a little outline on the right hand side of your paper that I'll have to be sort of looking at as I try to find the right pictures as well. First, I want to say a little bit about what I discovered, if you will, what I figured out by way of the help of the friend of mine who went. He's been several times to Israel, and he's kind of the Middle East scholar in the department where he teaches, where I used to teach at UPS as well. We visited several places. If you look on your map, I did not go to there. He went to a town just outside Gaza Strip, which of course is a Palestinian zone. That was one of the days I was sick. I was sick 3 days in bed, so he went on his own, but I missed that. I did go to Hebron, which is about where the B in Bank on West Bank in the yellow on the right-hand side is, a well-known city for both Jews and Muslims, and well-known for its conflict because of Jewish settlement in the area. And we went to, for the reconciliation side of the tour, we went to a school in near Bethlehem and a school near Haifa. We spoke to a man in Haifa who's ran a school in a village near there. So I'll give you the background, try to get you some pictures as well. I'm not going to go over the 1948-1967 aspects of the conflict, just to remind you of those important dates. Israel. Jews get Israel as a state in Palestine in 1948. There's some conflict. The Jordanians take part of what is now Israel. 1967, the Israelis take it back and then occupy what was, of course, what's called the Occupied West Bank. The zone in yellow, the Occupied West Bank, is heightened security. You know, we had to be stopped at the checkpoints most of the time, asked what we were doing. We were on a tour bus on one day, so they kind of knew what we were about. But to get into the West Bank is to be going into that area that you hear about, where there's Jewish settlements in Palestinian areas. I'll tell you a little bit about how it's different for Palestinians there than it is in Israel proper. So you would say, the ones we talked to said, Israeli Arabs if you live in Israel, and Palestinians if you live in the occupied West Bank. Now, I'm not saying that's the definitional truth. I'm just saying the ones we talked to spoke of it that way. So what I first began to discover or realize with the help of this friend of mine plus what we saw, there are several different groups in Israel and of Jews that are, they're not at odds with each other, but they're quite different from each other. And they have different views of themselves and of the state of Israel and of what the project of the Israeli life is. And so they're listed here. What we call ultra-Orthodox or Haredi or Haredim, are, you know, you would know them by their dress. They are, as my friend sort of hit the analogy, they're in some ways like the Amish in America. I mean, some completely separated from society in many ways, culturally and socially and spiritually. Of course, the ultra-Orthodox or Haredim in Israel are quite numerous, unlike the Amish. So, you know, we're riding the tram, you know, back and forth with lots of ultra-Orthodox. They have interesting status until the week we were there, the law expired that had granted them exemption from military service and had also granted them some amount of autonomy in their pursuit of study, which the state subsidized. And there are a lot of complaints about them. They aren't working, they aren't contributing, they aren't doing their part, yet they're absorbing all kinds of state resources while they see the state as fairly illegitimate in some ways, the state of Israel and its behavior and its conduct in the current climate. And again, I tell you, reporting back for what we discerned and heard and have read, I'm not saying I am a specialist in Israeli politics. Though if you ask me questions, I'll just, you know, make up an answer if I don't know, and I'll act like I, so be prepared for that. I mean, that's what professors do, after all, right? Right, Doug?
Yeah.
And then kind of move down the list a little bit, sort of in terms of their spiritual commitment. The Orthodox are what we'd be more familiar with politically. They'd be a group of people that, in a sense, have the official national religion, the version of the national religion, the religion that's sort of officially observed. They're observant, probably observant Jews, but very political. Netanyahu would be of this stripe. And most people would think they bend their religion to suit their political purposes. So Netanyahu, current prime minister, is you know, not particularly religious, but he'll invoke religion to his benefit. Ultra-Orthodox aren't much, don't do much in the way of settling, meaning moving to the West Bank and establishing a Jewish outpost. They don't even like to go to the West Bank as so much. Orthodox will be happy to settle in the West Bank, settle and establish a Jewish outpost. I'll show what that looks like here in a minute. Religious nationalists, or what we think of, we'd call Zionists, very clearly aggressively pursuing the expansion of Israel, the state, and in connection with, I mean, there's interesting articles I've read kind of connecting their notion of theology with the need to recapture, recover the land. Right, this is the land the Lord their God has given them. It's theirs by right. They they need to go do this, and they kind of meld their theology with that, and then happily use Israeli state instruments to get that done, and sometimes quite unpleasantly. I want to read in a minute. I'll read something I think that maybe sets a little background that helps us see some of the things I'm talking about. But secular and liberal Jews basically are increasingly marginalized as sort of polarization of religious nationalists who, you know, kind of take off on this nationalist project by way of their religion, and then the ultra Orthodox are you know, sort of out there on the ends of the spectrum. The middle, the median, becomes kind of underpopulated and then marginalized, and some of them are actually moving back out to the United States in particular, but leaving Israel because they're simply marginalized. The fellow who, the 20-some-odd-year-old fellow who toured us around Jerusalem that first day, is a secular Jew and feels, I think, in some degree alienated from what's happening in his own country. And so let me give you a little further on these religious nationalists, because they become important in our story, the story that I got to see in Hebron, not that it's the whole story. There are two strains, and they're present today as well, but this is historic, you know, last 100 years. I call them imperialists because of the attitude that is reflected. And then there's a group called revisionists, and that's the name that is, in fact, granted to them. I'm going to read you a little something from 1923, just to do a couple things, sort of give you the overview of what I'm talking about. And also, I mean, I think you'll hear that the nature of the problem is pretty clear even back then. And this is written by a revisionist nationalist, revisionist Zionist. He's a Russian Jew living in Odessa, I think, at the time, not Odessa, Texas. And his name's Zev Yabotinsky. To imagine, as our Arabophiles do, that they, the Arabs, will voluntarily consent to the realization of Zionism is foolish. In return for the moral, to think that in return for the moral and material conveniences in which the Jewish colonist, he calls them Jewish colonists, brings with him is a childish notion. So there's the imperialists think that, oh, we'll go and we'll modernize Israel or Palestine, and the Arabs will be grateful for that. Every native population in the world resists colonists as long as it has the slightest hope of being able to rid itself of the danger of being colonized. That is what the Arabs in Palestine are doing, and what they will persist in doing as long as there remains a solitary spark of hope that they will be able to prevent the transformation of Palestine into the land of Israel. There is only one thing the Zionists want, and it is that one thing that the Arabs do not want, for that is the way by which the Jews would gradually become the majority, and then Jewish government would follow automatically, and the future of the Arab minority would depend on the goodwill of the Jews, and a minority status is not a good thing, as the Jews themselves are never tired of pointing out. Remember that minority status is not a good thing, as the Jews never tire of pointing out. I'll make a comment about that later. Zionist colonization must either stop or else proceed regardless of the native population, which means that it can proceed and develop only under the protection of a power that is independent of the native population behind an iron wall which the native population cannot breach. This does not mean that there cannot be any agreement with the Palestine Arabs. What is impossible is a voluntary agreement. As long as the Arabs feel that there is the least hope of getting rid of us, they will refuse to give up this hope in return for either kind words or for bread and butter, because they are not a rabble but a living people. And when a living people yields in such a matter of such vital character, it is only when there is no longer any hope of getting rid of us, because they can make no breach in the iron wall. Not till then will they drop their extremist leaders whose watchword is never. I've been doing some excerpting here. When that happens, they'd be willing to discuss practical questions of their national identity. I am convinced that we Jews will be found ready to give them satisfactory guarantees so that both peoples can live in peace like good neighbors. But the only way to obtain such agreement with them is the iron wall, which is to say a strong power in Palestine that is not amenable to Arab pressure. In other words, the only way to reach an agreement in the future is to abandon all idea of seeking agreement at present. This is a revisionist nationalist statement, 1923, which, that, by the way, that fellow went on to become something of a Jewish terrorist in Palestine in the 1930s. There was plenty of conflict back and forth in the 30s, and plenty of terrorist activity, what we would call now terrorist activity. I hear a lot of things that are sort of still ringing true today. There is a wall around much of the West Bank, for instance. We drove next to it. Like I say, we had to be checked in through the wall. And you've read about the security fence. I also hear that the willingness to use the word colonist, I think, is in some senses quite, you know, quite telling. I will now show you a couple pictures. I want to make sure I'm following my outline. Some pictures that I think begin to tell a story about that. And I want to show them. I won't tell you what I saw. I don't want to try to make political claims to you or make moral claims to you. There is problem, whatever word that word's too weak. There are problems, issues. The conflict is rampant on both sides in both directions. So the town that my friend went to the day I was sick was a town where they collect up all the rockets that the Gazans shoot at them, you know, and store them in the police station and have them as display. So it's not that they're, and what I said the whole time is it's difficult. I mean, I was a student of communism in East Europe. That was my first area. And it was always easy then. Like, communists, bad guys. Everybody they subjugate, good guys. All right? The victim and perpetrator status is much more muddled, and especially across time. In fact, the guy who wrote the kind of seminal work defending the Arabs called Righteous Victims and explaining how they've been victimized by the Jews has switched. Peace process hasn't worked. The Arabs are the problem. So, you know, these things are vexing enough to people that they can change their minds that dramatically. So I can see everyone waiting with bated breath for the pictures, which I wish were in order, but are not. I'm going to try to figure out down here in this corner what the highlight one is, and then... it's going to end up being kind of a random walk, I'm afraid. This is just outside of the old city, looking toward, this is the Mount of Olives, which is largely now an old cemetery. And I took it on the way. It's right next to, this is actually a project that the Israeli government has undertaken called the excavation of the City of David. It's not thought to be the actual City of David. They're excavating this in a neighborhood, in an Arab neighborhood in East Jerusalem. The Arabs think, and the guy we talked to was just down the street from this, that there's a government master plan about redoing this area, de-Arabizing it, if you will, I guess. And I don't want to use the word cleanse, but a lot of people do think that there's a slow motion kind of cleansing going on, getting rid of non-Jewish populations. The primary way to do that is to find reasons why Arab buildings are not allowed to. They're ordered to be knocked over for some reason. You've seen this probably on the news before. The government issues 60 orders a month for destruction of Arab buildings. They actually execute 20 of these orders. So they're destroying 20, and this is actually in the Hebron region proper. This is not right here, but just to give you an example. And they issue one building permit per month. So you'll see why that's important later when they destroyed some cave dwellers' caves and now make them live in tents, but the tents are deemed illegal because they didn't have a building permit to put the tents up. So there's a whole, oh, look at that. That's the Holy Sepulchre. I don't want to be random, though. There's just the outside of the. I wish that if the pictures were in order, I wouldn't have to do this. This is how Jews built synagogues secretly in the old city while it was Arab occupied. They put the little bump out that points to Mecca would be for Muslims to make, so on the exterior it looks like, well, yeah, we're okay with that building, but inside it was a synagogue. This is a gate, nearest the Western Wall in Jerusalem. That's the evidence of the fighting in 1967. Okay, I'm sorry. We're going to come back to this because it's the wrong stuff. So, sorry, it's sort of random walk here. So let me tell you about Hebron, because this is where I saw it, heard it the most. This guy in the green shirt is our tour guide, and he's an Orthodox Jew, had served his time in the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, during which time he was sent to guard settlers in Hebron, the Hebron area. This is outside of Hebron, the Hebron Hills. We were supposed to go to Hebron, which is a few hundred or thousand Jews amongst, you know, tens of thousands of Palestinians. It's pretty tense. The police said we told the tour company we can't guarantee your safety, so they canceled that part of the tour. We went to the hills instead. He says he finished his time guarding settlers who by the way don't really like even having the IDF there, because in some senses it kind of constrains them, because there's a kind of radicalized portion of the settlers who are perfectly happy to take matters into their own hands, and they have all the power. So he finished his time in the IDF and kind of had some soul searching. He said, "What was I doing?" And he formed this group called Breaking the Silence. And they, among other things, they take these tours, give these tours. And so he drove us around to various places where we could look at Jewish settlements set down amongst Arab farmland. And this particular one, there's a couple things going on here that are interesting. You can't quite see the razor wire strung along the boundary of this property. But the electricity thing is important. What a Jew will do who wants to settle is build a building on a hilltop and creating a farm, or put a fence around it, build some other buildings, and the military will come out and run electricity out to the farm, even though it's illegal to do that, and often run water out as well. So in some cases, you see electricity wires running over a non-electrified Arab village on the way to a Jewish farm. And this is illegal to do by Israeli law, but nobody stops it. In fact, of course, the IDF actually advances the project. So there's this weird kind of dynamic where a Jew shows up on a hilltop in the middle of this Arab neighborhood or Arab area. And of course, then Israeli state machinery feels this need to provide protection for them. And so they send people out who then also provide services like this. And they call it, there's a name for it, a nickname for it. They say it's the facts on the ground. The critics of this program say that, you keep putting Jews in different places, you run electricity out of their house. The facts on the ground are that there are Jews out there. So we now have to live with that new reality that, by the way, we just created. So, I mean, this is, I'm summarizing the argument that this guy gave to us. I'll tell you the one that bugged Sandy the most later, but the one that's always surprised. In 1990, this is just down the street, to our right, is a guy who was an Afrikaner in South Africa. And in 1994, if you remember your history, that's in South Africa, that's when apartheid is over. And he converts to Judaism. And now owns a farm in Israel, top of a hill. I don't know, maybe I'm the only one who thought that was extremely opportunistic. He owns a farm in Israel. It happens to, by the way, be called the Lucifer Farm. I don't know what his intention is in naming it that. I don't know if that means something else in some other language, but I was sick this day, too, and actually I kept thinking, he's not saying Lucifer Farm, is he? He wouldn't be saying that. And we looked it up, and indeed he was. So that's a technique. I have to tell you about that later. Well, I can tell you this one now. We went on the same day with that gentleman I just showed you. We went also. We're in a big tour bus, and we're on dirt tracks all part of the way, and out in the middle of nowhere. And he said, "Well, I'll take you to a Bedouin village." So we drive up this kind of windy road, and this is a Bedouin village. you can see by the tower there, you can see nice houses. That's a Jewish settlement. So they are this close sometimes. And this Bedouin village, these had been cave dwellers, and he said the IDF had destroyed their caves, and that they live now in this village, which you see is tents and this stone building, cinder block building with some sort of makeshift roof. The odd part, our bus drove up and we approached the gate of the settlement, and of course we couldn't go any further. So we, kind of 15-point turn to get back around, and it's right in the midst of this village, and these kids are running around looking at us like, what in the world is that? This is the detritus of the IDF having bulldozed parts of the village before. So there's a pretty hard juxtaposition here of life and lifestyle. The Jewish settlement, you can even see the electricity wiring here, and they clearly do not have that in their village. Only in this case, only about 100 feet away. The Bedouins also are nomadic, as are the Arab cave dwellers, and they have bits of land here and there and everywhere. And so the Israeli courts come up with rules like, well, your home is where the majority of your land is, so you may now never go over here because we've co-opted that. So things like this that they may sound legal, but they're rather disingenuous in many cases. This is just down the road from where we were before. I found this is one of my most frustrating. This is a settlement. It was most disheartening to me. This is a settlement that had changed, that forced a change in the route some Arab kids walked to school. And so this is, I suspect, a group of radicalized settlers as some of the Israeli pullback from certain places has been undertaken. Some settlers have been radicalized. It's like, okay, fine, we're going to just take this on ourselves. And so there's settler attacks on Arabs and there's Bedouins. And in this case, the kids had to walk to school now in front of these houses. I can't quite, there's a little bit of a road you can kind of see. And one day, some sort of Christian group from Scandinavia was escorting the kids. So the settlers came out with chains and beat these escorts. Then the court said the IDF had to take these kids. So the IDF would ride in jeeps and the kids would walk behind them to school, and they came out and started stoning the kids. So the IDF soldiers put the kids in the jeep and they walked behind, and the settlers threw bricks at the soldiers, their own soldiers, knocked some of them unconscious. One of them discharged his weapon in the air. He was court-martialed and put in the brig for a month. The settlers endured no legal ramifications. So this was one story, one example. I know, it's not the only example like this. And I'll just leave it at that. And you can see plenty more settlement over on the left side there. This is looking from Lucifer Farm down toward the Dead Sea. Interesting thing, they claimed this. The Israeli government claimed this as a firing range, and so everybody had to get out except the Jews. Some of the Bedouins that we encountered later, the guy said that some of their land had been in this zone. Actually, what he said was they had half their land in this zone and half somewhere else, and the court ruled that this was their home. This was their home, but they couldn't go, and so where they put up a tent now is illegal. We met a village of Arab cave dwellers, and now tent dwellers. This is their village in the front, and you can see the settlement in the background, in the middle ground right up here. And there's just more of their tent. That's back at the Bedouin village, so excuse me for that. I meant to start again. I'm sorry. I apologize for the disarray. This is Jerusalem in the Arab section of Jerusalem. This is Ariel Sharon's house. He bought a house in the Arab section. Most people argue to establish a Jewish presence. He never lived there, but he has this house. It's now still there. as a
who is that?
Ariel Sharon, former prime minister. Moore, Western Wall. Have I gotten everything there? Okay. So I don't want to make political comment necessarily, although of course everything I'm saying has a political aspect. I will show you. Oh, I'm sorry. One more. I missed also the day of being sick. I missed the day. I mean, sick is not. If I were sick, I would have probably gone. Unable to keep even water down, and feeling like I was passing out all day. I thought it was wiser not to go. My friend went to also West Bank, but north of Jerusalem, Nablus and Jenin. Names you, Janine, you may have heard as well. This is a piece of, this is some graffiti on a house. Secularists against Arabs. The Jewish people live. Death to Arabs. But also, this is an Arab commemoration to the people named there eight names near the bottom are men who've been martyred fighting against the Israelis. Interestingly, upper left, never forgive, never forget. So it's not a one-directional thing. The friend of mine was telling me they went to, shops in these village in these refugee camps for palace for Arabs. Posters of all the martyrs, posters of Bin Laden, posters of celebrating every man, young man who'd been martyred. They'd have a pose of him with weapons, and so there's a happy embrace of violence on their side as well. So I don't mean to say this is something unilateral. We went. My intention, and you'll just pardon me for this. My intention was to go, hoping to meet people who are doing something different about all of this, and who, by the way, we don't get much coverage of because they're not very important or they're not very well known, and because it doesn't really fit the sort of easy narrative structure of the there's this conflict and you got to figure out which side you're on. So if we must defend Israel. No, those poor hapless Palestinian Arab victims. Then we try to make some sense of it. I couldn't make a lot of sense of it. But I did like to try to make sense of the fact there are plenty of people doing things like this guy, whose name is Elias Shakur. He's the Melkite Catholic Archbishop in Haifa. Now, I read about Melkite. It's now increasingly, I guess, just an adjective that doesn't really mean much anymore. They were a kind of rump Catholic that the Western and Orthodox churches fought over, and now it's all just kind of melted away. But interesting man. Sandy and I have read, I know his books, and I don't know if any of you have heard him before. A Nobel Peace Prize shortlister a couple of times. He sent off to this little tiny village to be parish priest. After he had gone, get his training, which was shortly after the Israeli forces had come and destroyed his family's farm in 1948 when Israel and the Jews got Israel, kicked them off and put them into refugee status. He, parish priest in this little village, and he starts a school. He says, I welcome Arab Christians, Arab Muslims, and Jews. Jews never want to come. He's a pretty remarkable guy. My friend, who we both went, my friend, I should say, not a believer, and was powerfully overwhelmed by this guy. He's pretty impressive. He for instance, even in he's an Israeli citizen because he lives in Israel proper. As an Arab, this is the one that bugs Sandy the most. As an Arab, he has a 2 stamp in his passport, where Jews have a 1. You can imagine what that means. He's a second class citizen. And the reference in the guy I read talking about, what did I say to remember? The minority status is not a good thing. And Sandy kind of laments, didn't this just happen to the Jews themselves a few years before? And he doesn't like it, but he's very cheerful about, I'm going to go do these things. I'm going to build a school. Even though, again, couldn't get building permits. So in 38 years, he was in court 37 times because they would try to knock down his building because he didn't have a permit. He'd often build, I remember reading he had to run an extension cord from one building to the next to be able to power everything in the other building. So he just goes and gets this done. Rick Damask read the book as well, reminded me. He one day, there was a lot of conflict within his congregation. So after services, he locked the door and said, "We're not leaving till this is solved." And then they sort of worked all the, and the village kind of came back together. I mean, you think, oh, you know, come on, you must be kind of, you know, fluffing the story. And then, but you meet the guy and say, no, I don't think he's fluffing that story. I mean, he's a remarkable fellow. He lives and works in Haifa, which the picture of which was that hillside of the green steps. That's actually the Baha'i Gardens, which is a variant of Shia Islam. Baha'i are not supposed to live in Israel, but the founder of Baha'i ended up buried here for some reason. Don't ask me why. Another that we went to see is, you can guess where that is, right outside Bethlehem, where this fellow runs. That's the soccer field. Yes, it's concrete. Grass doesn't really grow all that great. This fellow runs, he's also an Arab Christian, runs a school that is connected to a strain of Lutheran church here. A lot of Lutheran churches here support the school. Same kind of thing. You know, kids, bringing kids, try to get them education, desperate to, these kids would love to get to American university. So I thought it was interesting to meet him and look at his school because they run it on a shoestring. We asked both of these men, you know, what's it cost for a student for a year? And they said, $500 to $700. You know, you might remember in Washington State, we spend $10,000 per student. And I think that's more than the difference between our standards of living, but they don't have a ton of brand new computers. They aren't thinking about, should we get every student an iTouch for the class and then send them home with laptops? They have four computers. They say, oh, these are really old. He's desperate for people to send him books. But here they are on a shoestring. They run this school. And they say, I asked them directly with an intent to try to work reconciliation in their community first and then make opportunity for people to go to, you know, do this work further. One of the two I just showed you said he thinks that the Israeli state just doesn't want Arabs getting education. So they just take it upon themselves and get this done. It was nice to see. It was also interesting to see. I was supposed to make a third trip in Bethlehem, or another trip to Bethlehem to meet a third person who is connected to a friend of ours here in the area who does consulting work with World Vision, training Hamas leaders in nonviolence. So there again. And this, we couldn't go, I was sick, and this fellow's name's Sammy. And it turns out that this fellow Sammy is known to everybody. So the guy I just showed you knows Sammy. A young woman that my friend knows who came over, a student of his who met us there, went around for a couple of days, met this guy, worked for Sammy while she was there. She was interning at this organization. And Sammy's parents were the one teaching Arabic to the Americans who were running this, the Americans supporting this guy running the school, who my friend and I made their connection in the first place. So everybody knows everybody. And so in some ways it was kind of interesting to hear and meet people who are working in similar directions, and they're all woven together. So that was kind of in some, I would say, reassuring. I wanted to go and find that there was work being done that was not the destruction, not the conflict, not embracing the sort of normal categories of the problem. I did as only personal observation. I came away with, you know, you wouldn't be surprised. I don't think man-made solutions short of violence, which the guy we read embraces, I don't think those are plausible. I'm glad to see someone like this doing this work, and, you know, I hope it's God's work, and there's possibility for things to get done through work like this. But the dominant strain, if the Israeli state's willing to flout the rule of law the way they seem to be, and everyone is happily using violence, in the short run, man-made solutions seem difficult. I don't know, Steve, I talked quickly with Lori, and she said that Lattie was felt like that was had a similar kind of response. And I don't know if you guys had conversations like that or not, but that's kind of what I arrived at. Happy to see this. Sandy and I have even thought about participating with one of these works at some point in the future, since I am a teacher. Hope it goes well. That being said, you know, this is man has created a mess in this environment, and I don't know the way out. So, Steve, did you know the way out? Will you find the way out?
I'm working on the perfect solution.
Yeah? Yeah. You're going to save that for later in the campaign,
yeah, right?
So, okay, that was a whirlwind. That was a whirlwind of not of Israel. It was my 7 days worth of traveling in Israel. That's the dangerous amount of time, because I think, oh, look at all the things I know now, and I can say, and I really actually know very little. So I hope I've left no time for questions, because I've told you everything I know. So, no, any observations or questions or?
I have a question.
Yes.
Why would an Israeli want to have a farm in the middle of all that violence?
If you're a religious nationalist, you want my answer? I mean, I think the guy is saying, you know, we're going to go, this is our area, belongs to us, granted to us by God. That's a religious nationalist. Granted to us by God. We have to go get this back. The balance of power is with the settlers. The village I showed you, the Arab, the guy we were talking to, his hand had just recovered from getting beaten up. So the balance of power and authority is with the Jews. So it's that, you know, I think I would guess they think, well, you know, we got, this is the price we got to pay. The more negative rendering is, yeah, they're trying to do their part to cleanse the area. People have said that. I'm not saying I'm saying that. I think it's pretty, could be construed that way pretty clearly if you want to. So I guess there's this kind of messianic, if you will, vision of their recovery of the land. That's what some people I've read say. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me, but their view of the world doesn't make sense to me in general. So, yes?
How were you received as an American?
By whom? We stayed in slightly into the Arab side of Jerusalem, and that was fine. The Archbishop said, oh, we work with everybody. Presbyterians, you know, Episcopalians, Catholics, you know, Baptists, we work with anybody. So, I experienced no problem. Now, if we'd gone to Hebron on the tour, they told us that the settlers know the tour guides by name. They'll come out and they'll heckle and they'll jeer and they'll throw things at. And so I think we'd have been swept up in that. Because I think that group is just nervous about everything. So, my friend said last time he'd gone through, they looked at his camera for a long time. So he said, let's not take our pictures of Hebron back with us, because they'll say, what were you doing here? So we cleansed our cameras of those pictures. So that part, and there's a lot of nervous, you know, get to the border or get to the airport and going through security, and there was something. We had a yearbook from that guy, the Bethlehem. So we had a yearbook, and she's looking, what's this? And it's a book from this school, and she calls over her supervisor, what's this? And you know, we explain it. He's looking about, you know, asking some questions, and there's just a lot of anxiety, I thought. So we weren't personally, I didn't have any personal problems, but you know, there hardly aren't armed police and military everywhere. And it's just sort of nerve-wracking. So, but you know, stayed in an Arab-owned hotel. It was very nice, and you know, interactions were great, and no personal problem, right? Does that make sense? Okay. Other, no?